extremely good job, and they have no acids. Some of the Celestics, and you'll have to do some research on this one, Dow Corning? I think Dow Corning is one of the major manufacturers, or General Electric. They've got five different formulas, and you can look up their specifications as to how acidic they are and whether or not they're going to etch your board, so to speak. I think very few people have had a problem with properly cured Celestic adhesive, you know, the rubber stuff that's used for caulking a tub, so to speak, but the more exotic commercial version of it. I'm having trouble believing that that's really going to create damage to your PC board. Let me first turn it over to the net. Other people have had problems with using Celestic-like adhesive, rubbery adhesive materials to remount a printed circuit board. Has anyone had troubles with the new gluey material creating grief on the PC board? If you know something about that, please give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
PC to WGB.
Go right ahead, John.
I think if he looks on the label, he'll see acetic acid in a lot of them. If you're using it, it smells like vinegar, don't use it. You can even use rubber cement, which is really harmless. That does a good job, too.
When it comes to the vinegar smell, which is a kind of an acid, do you believe that acid is strong enough to really create damage to the PC board, or is it just going to create some physical discoloration that this doesn't look as well? Do you think the circuit is not going to work after that? What's your guess on this one, John?
I've used PhenoSeal, and I've also used the white caulking by GE, and they have a clear also. I've used all three of those. I've never had a problem. Many of the boards had tropicalized spray on it. Some of them were just bare copper, and I had no problems at all. I would say if you're dealing with high voltage, I would wait until the acetic acid evaporates before you turn it on. But that's about it.
In case you 2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah. Glenn recognized some of the PC boards have a fungus proofing or HumaSeal coating on it to make sure that fungus doesn't build up on the board when it's used in an environment that's got high humidity, you know, like a jungle somewhere. Glenn, what's your take on all of this? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
I think for the average ham, there's no real problem with the acidity inside most of the common RTV silicones that could be used. The interesting thing there is that my only warning for anybody when you seal something with RTV silicone is that, my goodness, you better make sure that that circuit is something that's near bulletproof, because if you ever have to service it again, boy, is it going to be hard to pick that stuff out. The other thing is that there is a material called Silguard 160. It's a two-part material. It's RTV silicone, but it's like a white and a gray, and you mix the two together, you know, one part to one part mixture, and it just dries into a very pliable RTV silicone. Where that's used is in outdoor fixtures, where I've experienced using that in, like, LED drivers and ballasts that have to be mounted in outdoor lighting fixtures, and they need an ingression ratio of IP67. That means that you can't have be susceptible to dust, water, condensation, anything. And that two-part material, when mixed together, is like bulletproof. But there again, you better make sure that that circuit doesn't have to be serviced. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
That Silguard 160 sounds like beautiful Stucci stuff. What brand name? Where do you buy it? Roughly how expensive? Glenn number two, go ahead. Correction, Glenn number one. QCQ, KC2QCQ, QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
You gotta be careful. I think there's a QCQ in the club too, or something, some call sign close to that. But the Silguard 160, you know, my goodness, I wish I remembered the manufacturer, because we're actually getting, I'm using it on the job, but we're using some kind of like a Chinese equivalent to it. But, oh my goodness, I'm about to say Dow Corning. I believe it. That's a Dow Corning, Silguard 160, and it's two-part material. But there again, and how expensive is it? You can buy it in... it's not cheap, Dick. It's going to be more expensive than regular RTV. I would say probably to fill You know, say 310 milliliters worth is going to probably cost you around $10, so it's not that cheap.
2KEY.
Go ahead, Mel.
About the stuff that they sell in the tube for sealing windshields.
Got an opinion on that one, Glenn?
The only problem that I've found with some different silicons isn't that they cause damage like acid to the board, although I've heard that, but I've never seen it. The biggest problem that I've seen is EMI. I will test a circuit, and we run conducted EMI from 150 kilohertz to 30 megahertz and conducted, and then we do the 30 to 1 gig, and then 1 gig to 3 gig. And typically, when we start adding these kinds of silicons around the circuits, you can definitely lose your EMI filter performance if you use the wrong silicon. So if you've got a circuit with an EMI filter in it, think twice about putting silicon around it. The Siligard 160 is one of the better ones. In other words, it doesn't interfere with the EMI filter as bad as others, but it still is going to have an effect. So a lot of times if you have a circuit that's EMI sensitive that could generate noise, you put the Siligard around it or other silicons, you could wind up with an EMI problem that you didn't have before. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Suggestion, Dick?
Go ahead, John.
Dick, if you're working with a small printed circuit board that doesn't have a heavy component on it, I've done this many times where I was worried about that, especially in high frequency, I put a little dab about maybe a half inch thick on each corner where there basically is no printed circuit copper, and then just smush the board into it a little bit, hold it there for whatever, with a rubber band or whatever he wants to do, and this way you won't have to worry about it eating anything up.
And I also like mechanical mounting if at all possible. Glenn number two, N2ZEA. The printed circuit board that you're about to remount, you said remount. Does that mean it was once mounted? Is it an RF circuit? Is it a high voltage circuit? What made it demount itself? Mike, want to give us a couple more words here, Glenn number two. N2ZEA, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Okay. It is a green targeting laser for a rifle, and the board on it is very, very tiny. It's probably only about a quarter inch by quarter inch, and I'm guessing it has something to do with the power supply. There was a component, a surface mount that came off, so I picked off the rubber and then re-soldered it on, and I got to remount it back on. I guess it's got to be elastic and soft.
Yeah, you've got a slightly more complicated situation here. The alignment of the laser itself, you care about that, so carefully positioning it as you glue it down. Also, the printed circuit board that's in series with these lasers, in most cases, it is a very precise voltage regulator or current regulator. Because if you give too much voltage or too much current to the lacing diode, bad things can happen. Too little current, it's too dim, it doesn't give you full performance. And as such, some of those circuits, the actual regulator itself, needs a heat sink. The possibility exists that the original mounting is a thermally conductive material into whatever the local metal housing was to heat sink that regulating device. Now, the guy who works a lot with light-emitting diodes, and these laser diodes are the first cousin to those, with their voltage and current regulators is Glenn number one. And so, Glenn, should he be concerned about the heat sinking of that printed circuit board, which probably is a voltage regulator or a current regulator? KC2QIQ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Dick, am I making the repeater on the safety?
You're a little bit noisy, but we can hear all your words, so go ahead and proceed.
Yeah, sorry about that. I had to step out of the shack for a minute with DHT. But what he's looking for is not a silicone. That's a thermally conductive epoxy. If you go on the net, just do a Google search for thermally conductive epoxies, you'll find them. And usually they're like a white in color. It's a one-part material, and you have to allow it to dry at least 24 hours before you turn anything on. And it becomes quite strong, but it's still somewhat pliable. But that's definitely not an RCD silicone. That's a thermally conductive epoxy. and you can definitely Google that and get them all over the internet.
Don, good information, Glenn number one. So Glenn number two, there's a high probability that that original material was a thermally conductive epoxy. In order for you to get full performance out of that laser diode, you probably have to heat sink at least one of the components on that printed circuit board. And without that heat sinking, you may not get proper performance for a reasonable length of time. You may put in a weak set of batteries where the regulation doesn't have to do very much work and everything's hunky-dory, and the day comes when the batteries run down, you put a fresh set of batteries into your laser pointer, if that's what it is. Now the regulator is dropping more voltage, dissipating some current, and without that heat sinking, the circuit could be damaged. So there could be more going on here, Glenn. And so thermally conductive epoxy is recommended, as you can tell. N2ZEA, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, I'm really glad I asked now. Do you guys have a favorite supply house you can get this stuff at?
Let's see if Glenn, number one, when he told you that when you Google thermally conducting epoxy, you're going to find a number of brand names. But let's see if Glenn has a favorite brand and a way to buy it. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I don't have a particular favorite, Dick, but I do know that there's quite a few of them available. Most of them work well. They're usually good to, I think like 150 degrees C. That's their rated temperature ratings. That's one thing you want to look for. I would just look on the internet, and you probably just need a small tube of it. It's just a one part. So you just have to put a little dab between the part and the heat sink in order to hold that down. And the stuff works, fairly decent. I've used a couple of different types of it, and it's generally okay. Where I've used it a lot is with producing load fixtures, where we actually take real LEDs and the high intensity ones, and we glue them to a sheet of metal. And basically what we do is we use this thermal epoxy just to glue the back of the LEDs down to a heatsink piece of metal to make a load fixture for testing LED drivers. So they do insulate quite well. They hold up to fairly decent temperatures, and they are somewhat available. I would just Google it, and for like lab purposes, we buy them most of the time just over the internet, and let me look for the best price. Back to the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Very good, Glenn, and thank you for that information. I would also try to make the thickness of the conductive epoxy on the one particular component that probably needs heat sinking. You want the thickness of the conducting epoxy, the thermally conducting epoxy, to be as thin as possible. If you used a real thick layer of this stuff, even though it's thermally conducting, you're now adding a lot of extra thermal resistance. Of all the laser pointers that I own, one of them apparently had insufficient heat sinking of that circuit, and therefore when I'm outdoors and I press the button, I get a nice blast of light which changes intensity in time, because that circuit has either been partially damaged or is not being properly heat sunk. So it's something to worry about a little bit. I owned both red and green 5 milliwatt lasers, and the green, of course, because of the response of the human eye, is a hell of a lot brighter. I also own a 30 milliwatt one that I bought at an astronomy show. And my goodness, does that give you a light sword at nighttime. You got to be careful where you aim it. So I'm kind of curious, your particular laser emitter, ZEA, that Glenn, is it red, is it green, how many milliwatts, if you want to tell us, sir, we're a little bit curious. N2ZEA, K2RIW in the TechNet.
It's a green one, and it seems very, very bright. I think it's 5 milliwatts, but it really shines all the way up to the clouds. It's cool.
Yeah, on a slightly foggy night, I have a lot of fun aiming that at my 100-foot tower and standing at various distances. Or if you aim it at a speed sign, in other words, a 30-mile-per-hour speed sign, which is really a beaded screen, and you aim a laser green pointer at that, my goodness, is that bright. And one of the experiments that I've done, you might want to consider doing, it's a lot of fun, is to stand 200 yards from one of those signs, and the laser pointer will create a great big circle of light that almost fills up the sign. But if you carefully aim the laser pointer into the eyepiece of a large telescope, in my case it's an 8-inch Cassegrain, Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, and you carefully focus the telescope on the sign, and then aim the laser pointer through the eyepiece, you'll get a small dot of light at the sign 200 feet away, as if you were standing 5 feet away from that sign. Very interesting experiment of using a good astronomical telescope as a collimator. What you're really doing is you're spreading the light over a much larger area and keeping it in phase by the focusing of that telescope. And now you can beam that light very long distances. That's another experiment you might get a lot of kick out of doing, Glenn. N2ZEA, K2RIW on the TechNet. Come back and let us know how it all turns out. You got it, Glenn, number two.
KEY comments.
I'm now recognized, but Glenn, number two first. Go ahead, Glenn.
That sounds like fun. I actually have a Celestron. Yeah, I can do that. I'm going to try it. Thank you. That's a great idea.
Go ahead, Mel.
Did not the FAA make a whole hullabaloo over that green laser being aimed into the sky? Over.
There's a yes and a no to that one, Mel. Unfortunately, if you go to an unscrupulous dealer on the internet, you can buy 100 milliwatt, 300 milliwatt, maybe even 500 milliwatt lasers. There are a couple of YouTube videos you can go to and a couple of websites where you'll see a guy taking a red, a green, or whatever, one of these real high-power lasers, and bursting balloons, lighting matches, burning holes in wood, and whatever. Some of these real high-power lasers are potentially very dangerous if they're aimed into the sky. But you take a 5 milliwatt laser, the ones that are properly rated for being so-called eye-safe, and you stand 5 feet away from somebody and aim it into their eye, it is extremely uncomfortable, but not damaging, 5 feet away. Yes, if the person held his eye open for 6 minutes and you aim it directly into his eye and he doesn't move the eye, yes, you're going to probably do damage to the retina in that particular spot, but that's an unusual situation. The normal blink response of a person when seeing a bright light like that will protect them, and pilots have recognized that the normal vision-averting response of a human being, as long as it's a 5 milliwatt laser, of course, to be friendly, don't aim it at a pilot, but even if they did, they really couldn't create the damage that people are talking about. But you take some of these super high-power lasers, wow, yes. And those things should really be licensed to qualified users because they're capable of doing damage. K2KEY, K2RIW.
1IFY2SWB
query.
We heard a triple that time. We'll eventually figure out who all that was. Mel first, K2KEY, go ahead.
Okay, I thought they were frowning on anybody aiming lasers, randomly up into the sky. I didn't realize that they had it under a category of the power of the laser, that it was legal or considered non-detrimental to a pilot if it's below a certain power. I had only heard that they were really going to enforce the law when it came to especially green lasers being aimed into the sky, Dick. Over.
The laser itself must have a level of divergence to it, obvious by the fact that when I aim it at a 30 mile per hour sign 200 yards away, that spot that starts off on my laser pointer at less than an eighth inch diameter, by the time it's gone 200 yards, the normal divergence, it's now filling up a circle that's 8 or 10 or 12 inches in diameter. So the signal is getting lower and lower in milliwatts per square centimeter. 200 yards, a person could stand there at 200 yards all day long and look at it. It wouldn't be comfortable, but it would not be damaging. So the properly rated, I think it's called 3C rating, or is it 5C rating, but the 5 milliwatt lasers that are being sold are really considered eye safe, and you would be an annoyance if you aimed it at pilots, and please don't do it. Even on a foggy night, on a slightly foggy night, it's most fun to use those because you get a light sword. However, when the foggy night is there, so you get, let me drop, so you get a nice, bright, Star Wars type light sword phenomena. And if I stand 100 feet away from my 100-foot high tower, and I start aiming the thing first at the base of the tower and start aiming it at a higher and higher angle, on a slightly foggy night with a 150-foot slant range to the top of the tower, the light is almost thoroughly dissipated by the time it's gone at 150-foot range. There no longer is a bright spot on the tower, if you know what I mean. All of the vapor in between has done all of the absorption and reflecting and scattering of the signal. So on the nights when you can see it the most, it has the least amount of range. And on a really dark, really clear night, a well-focused 5-millimeter laser reflecting off of a good white building, you probably can see it at almost a mile, just barely see it. But it's not eye-damaging at any kind of reasonable distance to a pilot. Don't do it, but for you to really get in trouble with that, I think is the whole reason they want you to make sure you never aim one at a pilot is because there is a slim possibility some foolish person is using one of these super high power ones. They then could really create damage. One at a time, who are the people who just signed in on the subject? Give me a call.
N2APG.
Dave recognized. Who was the other person?
Yeah, KB1IFR.
Separate issue query.
I heard K1IFR, and I also heard query. Who was query?
That's KC2SWB, Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Whiskey Bravo. Query on a subject that you had mentioned you were going to cover a couple of weeks ago, and I'm not sure what you covered it.
Okay. Dave first, N2APG, go right ahead, Dave.
Yeah, hi, Dick, N2APG. I understand your comments about, you know, the potential for eye damage and things like that. I don't think that's the biggest issue that is of concern right now, though. I think the biggest problem in this day and age would be a perception issue. In other words, if pilots flying around feel, you know, that somebody is possibly trying to, you know, shine any kind of laser at their planes, I think that's going to be perceived, you know, as a threat and will be taken, you know, would be reported, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's the issue I think people have to be worried about. They're out there in the backyard, you know, doing some astronomy. Is that going to be perceived by law enforcement or other bystanders as a threat?
Yeah, I hope all the people using good common sense are not going to be aiming lasers, pointers at pilots and landing and taking off aircraft and whatever. But my experiments on normal divergence of normal lasers tells me by the time you get to 200 yards, it's not even uncomfortable to look at it because the signal is spreading out. It has to. There's some very basic laws of physics of diffraction which dictate once you know the number of wavelengths of diameter of the emitting surface, that predetermines the exact amount of best focused minimum beam angle in the beam width. If your particular emitting surface is 70 wavelengths in diameter, the best you can do is 1 degree of beam width. Yes, there's more than 70 wavelengths on some of these lasers. They're going to have less than 1 degree, but they're going to have something in that vicinity. The signal is continuously diverging as it moves away. Only if you had an extremely large emitting surface, like using a telescope, but then it takes very careful aiming, as you're about to discover. Setting this up is not easy. You may need some mechanical holding fixtures to properly hold the laser in front of the eyepiece. It's fun to experiment with high and low gain eyepieces. Go ahead with your question, Dave.
Yeah, just a little follow-up on that. When you're on the ground and you're pointing a laser up and you know, you're doing some astronomy, you from the ground, you can see it for whatever, you know, a certain distance. What is the, if you were a pilot and you were flying, say, at 10,000 feet, would you see a green laser being pointed up to you by Dave in his backyard, you know, doing astronomy?
KC2, QIQ.
Glenn, number one, recognized. Yes, you would see the green laser. but it would be nowhere near as bright as when you're standing 5 feet. It's going to be a hell of a lot dimmer when you're at 200 yards, and when you're at 10,000 feet, you will see it, but it's not going to be significant as brightness. At 10,000 feet, which is 2 miles, if 200 yards will spread it to, let me pick a number, 8 or 10 inches in diameter, 2 miles are going to spread it to 100 and some odd feet in diameter. You're spreading 5 milliwatts over hundreds of square feet. The power flux density in milliwatts per square centimeter is getting low real fast. A good eye will see it, but is it really going to create damage? I kind of doubt it. There's some basic physics here that you can't do perfect focusing unless you've got an extremely large emitting surface, and all of that surface is co-phase, coherent. Those are very difficult requirements to meet. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Dick, I don't think that the problem was at 10,000 feet. I think what they were talking about was that there was a list of airports. There were a list of, I think, like 10 or 15 airports that near the airport, when planes were coming in at lower altitudes, probably somewhere around the 5,000 foot, and probably close to that landing ceiling mark, coming into the airports, where pilots in the evening were coming in, and lasers were being pointed towards the cabins, and they were seeing like distractive reflections coming through the glass. And so I think it was really close, you know, the proximity to the airport that really came in question. But, you know, if you're, you know, miles and miles away from an airport, I don't think it's as critical. But I think that's where the whole issue would come in. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Without a doubt, every pilot who experiences a laser being aimed at him while he's in the landing pattern should report where he was, what time, what direction, and so on. So you can pin down the person who's doing that, and some law enforcement should visit him and convince him real fast to stop doing it. But the chances of that creating a accident are fairly slim, and let me show you why. Unless it's one of these super high power lasers, and that would require very precise aiming to really create the damage we're talking about. That pilot is he's fixing his concentration back and forth between the instrument panel looking at his landing requirement instrument, and he's fixing himself on the center of that runway, because he's got to properly line up that runway. His eyes are focused on that runway. And with rare exception, there isn't a laser emitter coming back at him from that runway. That's where he's looking. And yes, if a bright light starts coming in from the side, because while he's in the landing pattern, some child starts doing a foolish experiment, he has been instructed ahead of time to note where it's coming from, so to speak, but not to look directly at it for fear that he could create temporary blindness. He's given instruction not to do that. So you're going to be reported if you do it, and they'll eventually find out who you are. But the immediate danger that we all think is going to happen from the normal, properly licensed 5 milliwatt or less pocket-type hand lasers, laser pointers, the chances of them creating an aircraft accident is awfully slim, in my opinion, although maybe I'm a little bit naive. You might have another comment on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Comment also.
Yeah, I think you're right, Dick. I mean, overall, it's just that, like anything else, I mean, I know myself even driving. I don't think if I was driving in my car and somebody were to point a laser, it would be distracting to say the least, especially if it was green or red, because, first of all, I wouldn't be sure whether it was just somebody shining light at me or whether they're pointing a gun at me. So either way, I think it would be pretty startling. And if they're flying an aircraft, please don't point it at the pilots. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, you do that and the incident will be reported and they'll eventually pin you down. KC2WGB, K2RW, go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick. Glenn just happened to mention what I was going to say. You know, the pilot, you don't want to have him concerned with somebody developing a targeting solution and putting more stress on a pilot. That's probably what it's all about, too.
Yeah, That sounds right. So do be careful with those. I use a laser pointer rather frequently when I'm doing my work. Quite often I've got to point at somebody's screen. I even do it when I go to the dentist and they aim this camera into my mouth to show me the next tooth they're going to operate on. And I then point at their screen across the room and say, is that little thing, the filling you're working on, is that particular one there an amalgam or is it a composite? And is that tooth number 13? And I know the way they number teeth. I have a lot of fun with them, as you can tell. But that laser pointer, some of the people I worked with at my dentist, some of the people at my particular dentist really became enthralled with that thing. And I found some of these inexpensive lasers for $10 laser point pens one day. And I gave them to one of the people at the dentist's office. And boy, were they happy to have that. And so I get extra service because of that. One of the persons who signed in was K1IFR, is what it sounds like, Kilo 1, India, Foxtrot, Romeo. But I got something wrong with that call. Please correct your call. Please tell me your name, and then follow with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick. K1IFR or something that sounded like that, are you still there?
Kilo Bravo 1 India Fox Yankee. Yeah, I just had one question for you, Dick. Just wondering if that original K2RIW train whistle, if that's standard equipment or is that an option on this WV2 repeater?
If you talk to KE2EJ and KWA2CDL, these are the two guys who really control the repeater. And because this repeater during the TechNet uses IRLP and EchoLink and other kinds of linking things, and it takes all kinds of resetting of the machine, they want to be sure that people wait a long enough period of time in between transmissions for all of that resetting to take place. Therefore, they've come up with those multi-tones, is what I think you're asking about, Mr. KB1 IFR. So it's to reset things. And various times during the day, they sometimes have those multi-tones. So that's the whole reason for it. It's not trying to indicate that I need a four-tone train whistle. Okay, KC2 Sierra Whiskey Bravo. I'll start off with your name, sir, and your question, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel. And good evening to everyone on the net. This is Martin, Mike, Alpha Romeo Tango, India November, out in Flanders. Sometimes I accidentally fall asleep at the end of the night on the tech net, and I'm just wondering, about 3 weeks ago, you had mentioned you had read a great article, and I think it was the New York Times, in reference to like a new cell phone study or RF on one's body. And I didn't stay awake if you covered that topic. And if you covered it, I'd like to know what Sunday it was covered so I could go back to amateurradio.tv and possibly listen in. If you didn't cover it, I'd like to know that too. Again, this is KC2SWB. Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Whiskey Bravo, Martin out in Flanders. Back to you, Dick. Thank you.
Very fine. He's coming into the eastern input on the machine, the 147.375. The article I'm referring to is in the April 17th issue, Sunday issue, color magazine section, New York Times. And the article is entitled, Do Cell Phones Cause Brain Cancer? It's about a 7-page article, very well written. We did discuss it on last Sunday's TechNet, which was Sunday, April 1st. Correction, May 1st. May 1st is when we discussed it. And so you will find that discussion on amateurradio.tangovictor. And I think we discussed it somewhere between the second and third hour. Maybe it was the third and fourth hour. I'm not quite sure. I'll give you a 3 or 4 sentence synopsis. And the real synopsis of it, Martin, was, let me drop. Lots and lots of evidence strongly suggests, not absolutely proves, because you can't prove a negative. You can never prove there never was a pink elephant, if you know what I mean. To prove a negative is essentially impossible. But there's lots and lots of evidence suggesting that cell phones are safe as all hell. And even if there was a very susceptible human being, and maybe it's one human being per 100,000 in the population, who does develop a medical grief because of a cell phone, believe it or not, as bad as that sounds, that probably would not be justification for people to stop using cell phones. Close to 40,000 Americans per year die in automobiles. We don't outlaw automobiles. So you have to look at the risk-to-benefit ratio. You get a tremendous amount of benefit and safety factor out of a cell phone. You may think a cell phone is a toy and a convenience and a great way to stay in contact with all your friends and to do internet searching while you're walking around the campus or whatever. Let me drop. You could definitely make a case for the most important service a cell phone forms is human safety. When you're driving along or walking along or whatever and you see an automobile accident, a person has crashed into a telephone pole, the sheet metal has bent around him, he's trapped inside his car and he's bleeding. And you get on your cell phone and you dial 911, in theory, emergency services are rolling toward that accident in roughly 1 minute. There's no other service that can give you anywhere near that response time. So the safety factor of a cell phone, even if there is a risk, far outweighs that risk as currently can be assessed. The article tells you that the total number of brain tumors in human beings in the United States is 6.4 brain tumors per 100,000 in the general population, 6.4, a very low number. That's the total number of brain tumors. And now if you're going to say that 10% of those are caused by cell phone usage, which would make it 0.64 brain tumors per 100,000, even if that was the truth, it would be extremely difficult to confirm that with statistically significant data because, let me drop, that rate is so low that think of the difficulty to really confirm it, traceable to the Bureau. You start up with 100,000 people that use their cell phones in a normal manner. You start up with another 100,000 in the population that never use a cell phone for the next 5 or 10 years. And then after that period of time, you compare the cancer rates. And if the cancer rates are as low as one particular kind of brain tumor per 100,000, even then, the statistics is so darn small, you wouldn't even be sure. So even if you had the method of making the measurement, you wouldn't be sure because the rate is so low, and you can't even do the test in the first place because no way in hell are you going to find 100,000 Americans that have never used a cell phone for the next 10 years. So you can't do the test. All the epidemiological studies to date have not confirmed a correlation between cell phone usage and brain tumors. When it comes to anecdotal evidence, without a doubt, you're always going to find an extremely enthusiastic person who said, I always hold the cell phone on my left-hand side of my head with this particular radiation pattern, and that's the exact shape of the brain tumor that formed in my head. Aha, the cell phone did it. A person could feel very strongly that's true. That is not proof. You can see it's a difficult situation. About a very low incident rate, and it probably cannot be confirmed. And you study the physics of what happens with RF energy striking a human being, you realize it doesn't have the capability, once you study the real difference between ionizing and non-ionizing radiation. And maybe you're already familiar with those two terms. Back to you, Martin. KC2SWB, K2RIW in the tech net.
SWB. Very good, Dick. Matter of fact, that you gave me the dates and the title of the article. I actually jumped on the computer and I can still pull up the article to read. And one unfortunate thing out here on the East End, I guess in the last 2 years I've known about 4 people that have died of brain cancer. and every single one of them between 50 and 55. So, and it's just distressing when people all of a sudden get, you know, the cancers in the brain, and they grow to be the size of a baseball, and you wonder why. So, I'm always like to hear what's going on in relation to the. Thank you very much for all of the information there, Dick. This is KC2, SWB, Martin, out in Flanders. Good night to all. Back to Dick.
Now, I'm going to throw in a couple of more words on the subject of cell phones. I do not work for anybody that has anything to do with cell phones, per se. Well, that was mostly true until recently. I worked for a particular company that got purchased by a company that does produce some cell phones, but I don't work on cell phones themselves. However, I have strong belief from my radio exposure from 35 years of high-power transmitters at Airborne Instruments Laboratory on a number of military programs that RF energy is safe. We've been studying it for 60 solid years, and you can read that in the ANSI report, ANSI. American National Standards Institute, Charlie 95, C95 report. It represents 60 years of research at the United States. And there's a similar document with the United Kingdom from their Bureau of Radiological Health, and Germany has a similar document, Japan has a document, and so on. And they all hang together. They all found out the same thing. Our document has more than 1,000 references from the best testing laboratories on what research has been done on the subject of man and RF energy in 60 years. And so the RF just doesn't have the capability to do it. It can create heating, but they've been looking for 60 years for the non-thermal effect, the non-heating effect, haven't found it. You take a high-power cell phone, you hold it against your head, where you're getting, in the worst case, 1.6 watts per kilogram of specific absorption rate. I don't know the exact number, but that's going to create something like a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit of raise in temperature of the nearby material. So can a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit of raise in temperature, if that's the number, can that create a brain tumor? I think it's rather unlikely. That phone runs a small fraction of 1 watt most of the time. You lay on the beach in the summertime with the sun shining on you, and more...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You lay on the beach in the summertime, that sun is giving you more than 1,000 watts of thermal energy being pumped into your body. And your body tolerates that very nicely. You gotta be a little bit careful with wearing the right kind of sunscreen to make sure that the ultraviolet rays do not give you extra suntan. And once you start getting to the high end of the optical spectrum, and the higher frequencies than that, which means ultraviolet, near and far ultraviolet, and soft X-rays and hard X-rays. Now you're getting into the wavelengths, where the individual photons, the smallest particle of energy, has enough energy that it's like a microscopic bullet flying at you at nearly the speed of light, and it's capable of doing damage when it hits your body. And one of the signs of that damage is the minor form of it is excess sunburn from the ultraviolet. But when you get to lower optical, infrared, far infrared, radio, and whatever, the energy per photon, the energy per particle, can't do that. It's only thermal. It doesn't have the ability to disturb DNA or damage cells or whatever in anything except the thermal effect. And yes, radio energy, if you use tremendous amounts of it, like in the case of a microwave oven, it creates enough heating which can do a change that you and I call cooking. But you and I are not using handheld radios at anywhere near the power level that are capable of doing cooking. Maybe a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit raise. The nice thing about the human brain, let me drop, is that all of those beautiful neurons have to be bathed in their nutrients continuously, so there's a tremendous flow of blood and other fluids through that brain continuously, and it's a beautiful cooling system. So it's very difficult to create significant heating without the cooling dominating, if you know what I mean. The only experiment I know of for sure where they can measure a real effect from cell phones is they did a double-blind test where a bunch of volunteers were using cell phones, and some of them were active and some of them were inactive, and they didn't know which was which. and the people were being asked to do mental arithmetic. The people with the active cell phones, where they were getting an extra 10 to the degree Fahrenheit raise, that's my speculation, the high temperature people, were able to calculate the mental arithmetic a little bit more rapidly with accuracy. So is a cell phone damaging? Well, it allows you to do mental mathematics a little bit faster. So real damage has not been confirmed, and real brain tumors really are very difficult to confirm because the rate seemed to be so small. And even if the rate was real, the risk-to-benefit ratio wouldn't allow us to stop using them. Otherwise, we would have outlawed automobiles a long time ago. Let me give you one last fact on this one. Right now, very foolish townships, Hempstead is one of them, is being forced by federal law, by the Communication Act of 1996, by federal law, they're not allowed to use radio frequency biohazard as a reason for denying the siting of a cell phone base station. But they're sneaking it back in left-handedly by way of the 500-foot rule. Hempstead Town has said you can't locate a cell site within 500 feet of a residence, a place of worship, or a school. Where in the world does a 500-foot number come from? It's a pure rabbit hat trick. And if you exercise the 500-foot rule, there is no place in Hempstead Town where you can put a cell site. So they're all not going to be allowed anymore. Of course that's going to be struck down by federal law, because it's in violation of the Communication Act of 1996. But it's going to create a whole lot of moratorium and delay in between. And therefore the safety device that we should be emphasizing, because cell phones, is not being emphasized. It's being de-emphasized and being delayed. And the cost of ownership is going up. Craziness. You've got a telephone pole every 150 feet down almost every one of our streets. A high percentage of those 40,000 people who die per year die because they hit a telephone pole, a very solid object that creates a lot of damage to the automobile and probably to your body. Let me drop. A person from Europe can come to the United States and say, how in the world do you tolerate all of that ugliness, of all of that above-ground wiring and all of those utility poles every 150 feet? How do you tolerate that? And the answer is, we do not see them. They've always been there. We've wiped them out in our mind. They're not there. So the thing that is killing people, we ignore it. The thing that's saving people, we're trying to eliminate them. What the heck is wrong with that picture? And the 500-foot rule, if you really want to set a number, what is the right number? 5 feet. Not 500 feet, 5 feet. And even that has a whole lot of safety factor built into it. If you really want to get yourself in danger with radio frequency biohazard, you climb on top of a hook and ladder, 100 foot high, you position yourself within 2 feet in front of a fully radiating cell phone base station antenna. Stare into that antenna with your eyes open for 6 solid minutes. When it's running at the highest power, transmitting signals to the most number of cell sites so the customers can handle. Under those conditions, at that distance, you have crossed the threshold where you're exceeding the recommended exposure by the American standard. So the answer, not 500 feet, should be 5 feet. And these 6-month moratoriums, they're just creating delay. There's nothing good about it. And to force, the next thing that Hempstead Town is doing is force each person that wants to put up a cell site to confirm the need. That's very foolish. Because no matter what metrics that cell site gives Hempstead Town, they can't use the metrics. By the time they start describing reliability and power flux density and signal strengths and dead stone areas and percentages of coverage, the town can't use that number. So if they're forcing people who want to put up a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
To give a bunch, they're forcing cell site owners to give a bunch of metrics to prove the need. Well, the town can't use the numbers if they get them. The real proof is money. The fact that the cell phone company is willing to devote $500,000 to $750,000 of their profit-making money to establish the cell site, that is proof positive that there's a need. They're putting their money where their mouth is. They're willing to pay for it. That's the real proof. And to ask for the metrics to prove it is silly. So here's Hempstead Town coming up with these moratoriums, delays, and 500-foot rule and proof that is needed and metrics, all of which is foolish and delay and illegal and it's going to be struck down in federal law. I live in Huntington Town, and I'm very disappointed to find that Huntington Town has decided to copy Hempstead, and they're coming up with the exact same requirements and restrictions and moratoriums. It's only a small period of time before some smart individual who has somebody who dies in an automobile accident, where his relatives are going to sue the town for criminally negligent homicide, for creating the delay that created the grief, that created the unnecessary death, because the cell site wasn't being allowed. The cell site is a safety item. And if you want to say that, all right, we're going to restrict them because of aesthetics, you almost can support that one. Let me drop it. To a person who is not sufficiently technologically oriented, yeah, you might describe a cell site as an ugly piece of hardware. And maybe you're going to force it to have the right kind of screening. Maybe you're going to force it to really look like a tree. I can sort of understand that one. But all these other reasons for the restrictions, a strong misunderstanding of the word RF radiation, they're afraid of the word. And the word is just a misunderstanding of what the word really means. And to compare RF radiation to nuclear radiation and say that they both cause cancer is not an apple and orange comparison. You're comparing at least an apple and an orange are both a fruit, and there's some relationship. To compare nuclear radiation to RF radiation, you're comparing an apple to a piece of paper. There's essentially no relation between the two. There's only a relation in that word, radiation, and the misinterpretation of that word. You guys have heard enough, but this is sort of what Martin was asking. Some of my opinions on the article and the cell site situation in the first place. It's a safety item, and the crazy zoning laws are trying to stop them. And the things that are really killing people, we ignore them. I know it can be done better. And with any further comments or questions, give me a call that is right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
K2YL.
Glenn and Bernie in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
It's kind of interesting with a lot of these cases on Long Island that there are definitely three known chemicals that are identified that cause brain cancer and leukemia, two very, very closely related types of cancers with a similar cause. And it's exposure to formaldehyde, vinyl chloride, and acrylonite. And it's almost, in every case, everybody keeps on overlooking those chemicals, and they'll blame a cell phone. And, you know, the funny thing is about even the nuclear radiation, the kinds of cancers that are normally affected are usually things like the lower body organs, like kidneys are affected, and you know, other things. In other words, it doesn't show up in the brain, even with those kind. In other words, if you look at even like in Chernobyl, the types of cancers that people had, they weren't the types of cancers that people are complaining about in Huntington. Let me let it drop for a second. But those types of cancers are more commonly related to uses of formaldehyde, which is used as an industrial chemical, you know, all over the place. Vinyl chloride, they're used in many, many plastics. And the acrylonite, not so much here on Long Island acrylonite, but especially every place where you have textiles and plastics being used. And I think they also use acrylonite in dry cleaners. And, you know, any exposure to the eyes, ears, nose, mouth, you know, almost create direct, you know, injections of the bloodstream. So, you know, those are the kinds of things I would want to stay away from. Is the formaldehyde, the vinyl chlorides, acrylonites, those chemicals can be, those are definitely, especially young children could be exposed to them. But the cell phones, I think it's a sideshow, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
It's a sideshow of strong misunderstanding. Can you spell the word acrylonite, please? Glenn, are you still there? Can you spell acrylonite?
You just have to give me time, Dick. A-C-R-Y-L-O-N-I-T-R-I-L-E. Acrylon... Well, you pronounce it. You're probably better than me. K-2-R-I-W-K-C-2-Q-I-Q.
Close enough, Glenn. I'll find it with that. The nice thing about Google is that if you even in the vague assembly of the area of the correct spelling, Google will come back and say, do you really mean this? Whereas by comparison, for the time being, the ARL archives website, if you don't get the request exactly right, every single letter, uppercase, lowercase, and whatever, I can look up my own article. I know my call letters, I know my name, and I know the name of the article, I know the date and the issue and whatever. And 50% of the time it'll say, no such record exists. Makes me a little bit unhappy. They've got to make that one a little bit more friendly. Bernie, I bet you've got some opinions on the subject of cell sites and their zoning. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
No, I just wanted to get onto the question list. Back in RF range, and wanted to ask if you could put me on the bottom of the list for questions. Comment on your Google as the dictionary. My brother-in-law is a professional writer, and he said that they commonly use Google as the dictionary. That's the quickest way. K2YO.
I have done exactly that on multiple occasions. I know close to the right spelling of the word. I Google the word, and it tells me there are three possibilities. Which one are you talking about? Bernie, go ahead and ask your question. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
It's a very low-tech question, but it's a process question. My wife introduced me to one of her patients whose son is studying to become a ham. We talked for a little bit. I recommended that he listen to the TechNet. He already knew about the TechNet. He listened to it on his scanner. And he asked me, how does he ask a question? I said, well, it's very simple. Just send an email to Mel. Every night he reserves time for it. And then he asked the question of, how do I find Mel's email address? And I sat down at a computer. I went to QRZ. I went to the Kings County Radio Club site. I did everything I could. How do we find the email address to send Mel questions?
I'm going to pass it over to Mel in a minute to answer that question. But the best way he can get an answer to his question, the quickest way, is for him to communicate the question to K2 Yankee Oscar, because the fastest response is verbal, live, real, on the air. Bear in mind that Mel occasionally gets 300 emails per week, and each individual person sending Mel an email thinks he's the only person on planet Earth doing that. And they all want an immediate answer written, and they want a free consulting service. So we're really asking something beyond the call of duty in some cases. Mel has restricted it. He gives the answers to what he believes are new hams answering the normal questions that hams ask in the process of getting their license. Mel, I'll give it back to you for... trying to put words in your mouth, Mel, but I'm going to let you speak them. K2RIW, go ahead, Mel.
Roger, you had it right, Dick. Yeah, remember, I'm the clearinghouse, basically, for both Dick and myself, because many of the questions that I get are directly towards Dick. And I never promised. And he actually spoke for both of us, and I actually just going to echo what he said, that we're not running a free consulting service. And we're going to answer brief amateur radio questions, and I usually try to specify for young hams that are just getting into the hobby to clarify certain things that, of course, at first hearing are kind of complicated, as Dick says, when you hear it for the first time. So what we do is, again, I see read quite a number of them, and only the ones I can get to are very few, as you see, per Sunday night. So the best thing is, as Dick said, convey it to you, and we'll try to put them out here. Let me let it drop. However, if somebody does want to send me an email, again, I'll try to read it if I can. It's k2key@arrl.net. I'm not .org. I'm not an official member of the ARL, so it's .net, A-R-R-L, K2, my call, K2KEY, @arrl.net. And they'll I'll definitely pick it up. Okay, back to you, Dick, K2KEY, we're listening.
Pretty fine, Mel. So bear in mind that he gets as many as 300, and some of them are people sending us their college homework, their doctoral thesis. I mean, it's a left-handed compliment that they ask us to review this kind of material, but way beyond the call of duty. He emphasizes the newer, younger hams. that are getting into the hobby. We older folks have to try to do some proselytizing, I guess is the word for it, evangelizing, you know what I mean. And to a person who is a member of ARRL, a subscriber to the magazine and an ARRL member, the vast majority of them will have a set of their call letters at ARRL.